The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
The strategy we employ in making choices is called prioritizing. We consider the options, we weigh the alternatives, and we put things into order. The most important, the most desirable, the least desirable, the most likely, and so on. There are at least two things that can go wrong with prioritization. You can give priority to the wrong thing. The saying goes... the saying goes... What are the... Who is that guy? Look, we'll be stopping for liturgical dance shortly. The saying goes that no one ever lay on his deathbed and wished that they'd spent more time at the office. But perhaps it is true that many people get to some point in their lives only to discover that something that has been a great priority has not really been worth it. I have the privilege of speaking to people near the end of their lives, and people become reflective, and they often do have some regrets about what they have invested most of their time in, or how they failed to devote as much time or energy to something that they actually always thought was important, but somehow it never translated into their into the way they shaped their life. And that's the other problem that you can run into with prioritization. You can have the right priority in theory, but not in practice. In the religious sphere in which I operate, of course, this shows itself in what we might call nominal Christianity. The sense that, I acknowledge God in all things in theory, but in practice, I live as Lord of my life. Two problems with prioritization. You can give priority to the wrong thing, or you can have the right priority, but only in theory and not in practice. Jesus gave his disciples clear instructions about the priorities that they were to have. He said simply, seek first the kingdom. And he meant by that, seek, acknowledge, pursue, cooperate with God's way of doing things. God's power and authority, the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus claimed that he himself was the clearest expression of what God was doing in the world, that he represented the kingdom in his person, in his teaching, and in his activity. Jesus and his message, his person and his words, are the key to the kingdom, and Jesus said to his disciples, seek first the kingdom. Well, in Matthew chapter 13, which we've been looking at over the last few weeks, Jesus tells a series of parables, short stories to illustrate various points. And today, he tells a couple of stories about the priority of the kingdom to make two points. The kingdom is supremely important, and the kingdom divides humanity. Firstly, the supreme importance of the kingdom of heaven. Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought the field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. And now, it's very clear, isn't it? Jesus is saying there is nothing more important than seeing that Jesus is God's King, than welcoming Jesus as God's King, than acknowledging Jesus as your King. Here's a top priority. Welcome the kingdom. Welcome Jesus. Grab hold with both hands and don't let go. It's worth everything you have. And in the two parables vary in some details. In the first, We're told the man was full of joy at his discovery. We imply that in the second story, but that seems clear. In the first story, the man seems to stumble onto treasure. But in the second, the merchant is searching for a pearl of great value, and then he finds one that exceeds all his expectations. And the kingdom is like that. If you were to talk to some of the Christians in this room, you'd find some who said, well, you know, discovering Jesus was a complete surprise. I stumbled onto treasure. I stumbled onto Jesus. I would say that. I was just reading a book, keeping a promise to a friend, and I met the living God. The book was the Gospel of John, by the way. Others would say, well, something in my life made me ask questions. I hadn't been looking for long. I began a search. I found Jesus. And I didn't believe that knowing God could be so good, so powerful, so life-changing. I thought I was looking, but it turned out that it was God who found me. But the two parables have in common that both men sold everything they had to acquire the valuable thing. Both parables teach the supreme importance and value of the kingdom of heaven. It's worthy of being your top priority. The parable is not teaching that you can buy the kingdom. It's teaching that the kingdom is immensely valuable and worth everything you have. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? Nothing more important than God's kingdom, God's powerful activity through Jesus himself. Well, it's just another day. Children are being born, people are being married, discoveries are being made, the markets are rising and falling, so are the nations. Nothing more important than God's powerful activity through Jesus himself. Nothing more important than becoming citizens of the kingdom. Being reconciled to God through Jesus, being adopted into God's family through Jesus. If the kingdom of heaven is worth anything, it's worth everything, and nothing should be allowed to get in the way of us welcoming the kingdom. No relationship, no pleasure, no wealth, no status seeking should be allowed to stop us from welcoming the kingdom. Every conceivable sacrifice is worth making to be a citizen of the kingdom. Because the two men in the parable show us to have the kingdom is to have everything. A rich young leader comes to Jesus but cannot follow him, turns away because he loves his money too much. But no love of wealth should prevent us from entering the kingdom, and yet I've known many people to shrink back from God because they were more committed to amassing wealth. A ruler comes to Jesus at night, fearful of his professional reputation being called into question. But no concern for status should prevent us from entering the kingdom. A woman who has been passed from man to man finds dignity in Jesus. No scarred past should prevent us from giving full sway to God's King in our lives. The kingdom is worth all of that. If you welcome the kingdom, it will shape your relationships in faithfulness and purity and service. The kingdom is worth that. If you welcome the kingdom, it may mean declining some opportunity for advancement at the cost of illegality or immorality. But the kingdom is worth that. If you welcome the kingdom, it may mean a life of service that goes unnoticed and unacknowledged and unapplauded. The kingdom is worth that. I can think of a woman who spent 35 years translating the whole Bible into an indigenous language in the hill country of Papua New Guinea. She lived in a remote, isolated area. She never married. She saw her nephews and nieces 10 times in 30 years. She would say, the kingdom is worth that. B.B. Warfield, great Princeton theologian of the last century, famously never left his bride, who became an invalid on their honeymoon. He never left her for more than 2 hours at a time. So he declined prestigious appointments at theological faculties across America. He declined invitations to international speaking engagements, so that he was never away from his bride for more than 2 hours at a time. The kingdom was worth that. A young man in my congregation came to Christ as a teenage refugee on the streets of Islamabad. His brother went with him to the International Protestant Church the day it was bombed and was killed. His father has since contracted the death of my friend and has not spoken to him for over a decade. And he would say, through tears, the kingdom is worth that. Every conceivable sacrifice is worth making to be a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, because to be a citizen is to have everything. Jesus speaks of the riches of the citizens of heaven in the Beatitudes, the famous Beatitudes in Matthew's Gospel. Blessed are those who, and he lists off the riches of the citizens of the kingdom. They see God. They are God's sons and daughters. They experience God's comfort and mercy and provision. They are filled with good things. They have the power of God's Spirit, the wisdom of God's Word, the help of God's people, the comfort of God's love, the assurance of God's promise, the gift of God's joy, the abundance of God's provision, release from God's condemnation, the freedom of God's forgiveness, the privilege of God's adoption. And I could go on. What the men in the parable knew was that the treasure of knowing Jesus as King is worth everything you have. No priority could be more important. No sacrifice could be too great for you to have it. Can I put it in less religious terms? To have the kingdom, to have relationship with Jesus, is to have a place to stand, to have hope for the future, to be reconciled to yourself, to see beyond consumption and exhaustion, to connect with reality. But in the end, I've got to go back to the religious terms. It is to know God. The Apostle Paul puts it this way: though I have more reason to boast than anyone else, a Hebrew of Hebrews, a Pharisee, zealous and blameless, I consider everything a loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. First principle of these parables: the kingdom of heaven is supremely important. Make it your top priority. The second lesson from these parables adds urgency to the first. The kingdom of heaven divides humanity. Jesus says that the kingdom is like a dragnet pulled through the water, bringing up a great mess of fish. And after the net is pulled up onto the beach, the fish are sorted. Jesus says this is what will happen at the end of the age: a day of judgment, a concept that Jesus and all his listeners assumed. They assumed there was no justice unless there was a day of judgment. And on the day of judgment, a separation takes place that is permanent and devastating. The division between the righteous and the wicked. The difference between the righteous and the wicked is not their character. It is the priority they gave to the kingdom. The righteous are those who welcome the rule of God. the wicked those who reject it. The righteous are those who would exchange everything they have for the treasure of the kingdom. Wicked those who have other priorities. And notice there is an equality here. The men who purchase the treasure and the pearl sell everything they have to secure it. But whatever you hold on to avoid the kingdom, you lose that too. You lose that anyway. As Jim Elliot, the missionary martyred in Ecuador in the 1950s, he said, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Whatever you prefer, whatever you prioritize above the kingdom, you lose it. The kingdom will cost you everything. Whatever you prefer, you'll lose it in the end. Jesus says, with all the seriousness he can possibly muster, the matter of how you respond to God, his authority, his son, his king, the matter of how you respond to Jesus is a matter deserving your complete attention. Making Jesus your priority should be your top priority. I bury people. I stand over open graves with silent coffins at the bottom. And those who love the person inside the box toss dirt on top of the box. And I quote the Bible. We come into the world with nothing. And we go out with nothing. To make the kingdom your top priority is to secure your future and to make your present meaningful. Jesus says there's no greater priority than what you make of him and his kingdom. And that decision is dividing humanity. And the rest of the chapter illustrates the different kinds of responses that can be found. The first is understanding. Jesus says to his disciples, "Have you understood all these things?" "Yes," they replied. Well, we read the Gospels, sometimes we feel reluctant to accept the disciples' claim that they have understood. And yet, he has given them himself, Jesus has given himself to his disciples. He will make all things clear to those who seek him. And so it's worth hearing Jesus' question addressed to us. Have we understood the parables? Have we seen that he is the hidden treasure? He is the pearl of great price, worth anything we have. Have we seen what Jesus said about the soils? What kind of soil we are? Does the seed just bounce off us like seed off a rocky path? Or does it perhaps find a temporary, enthusiastic welcome which subsides over time or in the face of difficulty? Or is it that our hearts can be soft, rich soil to receive the word of Jesus and produce a great harvest? Have you seen that he is the mustard seed? Unassuming, seemingly insignificant, who one day will be the king to whom every knee will bow. Have we understood that? And then there is the second response. Jesus leaves Capernaum in Galilee and returns to the area of his hometown in Nazareth. He goes to the synagogue, and the people were amazed. And then they ask this question: where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? It's a question that might have come from humility. Where did he get this wisdom and these powers? But this question isn't coming from humility in the presence of the wisdom and power of Jesus. It's coming from indignation in the presence of the familiar. Matthew says they took offense at him. Because we don't like to be challenged, do we? Once we've settled on our priorities, once we've committed ourselves, once we've decided on our goals and our values and our perspectives, it's very disconcerting and very disruptive to have that challenged. To be faced with the possibility of an alternative which might be superior. Let me say that every Christian is a person who was confronted with the thinness of their own priorities in comparison to those of Jesus Christ. Let me say there's no shame in that. Or rather, it's a shame we all share. Every Christian is a person who will say, I sat on the throne of my life, master of all I surveyed, and then I met Jesus and realized he is the true king. My priorities needed to change in light of his great glory. There's no shame in it, or at least it's a shame we all share. But it is unavoidable. There can't be two popes in your own life. It's you or Jesus. And when he comes to his hometown, they're not happy. Isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't Mary his mother? Isn't this some wandering rabbi from 2,000 years ago? Why should I give any heed to him? Did he even exist? They took offense. They knew all about Jesus, but they couldn't answer their own question. Where did he get this wisdom and power? Humility would have said, we know something about Jesus, but obviously we don't know it all. We need to find out more. Humility would have taken that path. But it's a hard path to walk. And it was too much for the townsfolk of Nazareth. So, friends, I'm so grateful for your presence here and for your attention. There is no greater, no more pressing question, no greater priority than making your assessment of Jesus. A prophet not being honoured in his own hometown has become a proverb, but it wasn't a proverb then. It was just the truth. We're familiar with Jesus. We've locked him in a box. We know who he is. But a man was digging in a field, found a treasure, and went home and sold everything he had so that he could buy that field. And he was filled with joy. Treasure is Jesus. Well, thank you very much for your questions. There are a couple of questions on verse 52, so I might start with that. Thank you very much indeed. I omitted that from the address, so I'm very glad to have the opportunity to speak about it in the question time. Can you expand on Matthew 13:52? The owner of the house who brings out of his storeroom new treasures as well as old. Was he an antique dealer? Okay. Yes, an abiding interest of lawyers. Always ready to spot the antiques. Matthew 13:52 says this. Oops. It's the next page, Al. Jesus says to the disciples, "Have you understood all these things?" "Yes," they replied. Verse 52, he said to them, "Therefore, every teacher of the law who has become a disciple in the kingdom of heaven is like the owner of a house who brings out of his storeroom new treasures as well as old." I think this is part of Jesus' preparation of his disciples. He speaks to the crowd, then he withdraws and he explains the parables to his disciples. And then he says to them, "Do you understand what I'm saying?" And he uses this this further parable. I think what he is doing is saying, with understanding comes responsibility. With understanding of the identity and mission of Jesus comes responsibility for pursuing it. So he calls them teachers of the law. Now, certainly they would not have thought of themselves in those categories, especially not at that time. But that is, they will become, of course, evangelists and heralds as stewards of the message of Jesus with the coming of the Holy Spirit. And so I think it's right to say that out of the Jewish law will come the new wine of the gospel of the kingdom. Not that these are discontinuous, but in fact that they are continuous. That Jesus will say to them after his resurrection that he is the subject of the law and the prophets. And the responsibility of the disciples will be to unfold to others how Jesus is the fulfillment of God's promise of a Davidic king who will reign forever and ever. So out of the house of Judaism will come the treasure of the gospel. I think that's what he's saying. And that will be the responsibility of the disciples at that point. Does the kingdom of heaven affect our world now, or is it all looking to the next life? Yes, thank you very much indeed. No, precisely. That is precisely the point. It makes all the difference now. In fact, I think that was... there's a famous quote of C.S. Lewis, I said, who says it was precisely those who had their minds firmly fixed on the world to come who had made the greatest difference in this world. I think I might have said last week, you know, one of the immediate impacts of the worship of Jesus was that those who followed him were relieved of their fear of death. And no longer having a fear of death meant that the earliest Christian communities, in a way that was not typical and unknown in the ancient world, became those who cared for the sick and the dying, because they didn't fear to die themselves. And I think it's true to say that to this day, confidence in the resurrection and the life to come makes it possible to live in this world selflessly and patiently, to bear patiently with suffering and even injustice rather than rising up in anger and vengeance. And it makes it possible to live humbly as a servant of others, because Christians don't believe that this is the only life you get. You better get everything you can out of it. Christians all believe that the best is yet to come, that we don't get older and think my best days are behind me, far behind me. We all think that our best days are ahead of us, and that as the body, as Paul says, wastes away, inwardly we are being renewed, and we have a great inheritance. And because Christians have that view of the future, that radically changes what we are able to do and what we may give ourselves to. This does not mean that Christians live in this freedom in this kind of kingdom way as they ought. Undoubtedly, many are thoroughly consumed with the same priorities as everybody else. And no doubt that is part of the reason why Christian witness is not as effective as it might be. But when you see a person who is living consistently with their confidence in the kingdom, it shows. 2 minutes. Excellent. let me see. Uh, Well, here's a question about when. At what age do most people find the kingdom, and in what circumstances, and can suffering help? Well, of course, people come at every age. I know someone who became a Christian at 91. And it, what a mercy of God to keep that person alive so that they were able to turn to Christ. They do say statistically people it tends to happen before you're about 25. But thankfully, God will hear anyone who calls on his name at any point. And in what circumstances? In all kinds of circumstances. But in my view, it is true that when you are brought low by life, when you are forced to confront your own limitation, you are in a position where you may more readily acknowledge both your need and God's great provision.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.